The National Archives podcast series, Black Poppies, Britain's Black Community and the Great War, presented by Stephen Bourne. This talk was recorded as part of Diversity Week at the National Archives on the 27th of January 2015 at the National Archives, Kew.
Thank you. I will start by explaining one of my reasons for... There's several reasons why I wrote this book, but my main objective was to try and continue, because I've written other books on Black British history, to continue that work and to try and bring into the light, if you like, the First World War Black story, because the school curriculum in this country has embedded in it the African-American stories, Dr. Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, the American Civil Rights Movement. The British school curriculum teaches our young about African-Americans from history and encourages that at the expense of Black Britons from history. The only exception they've made is Mary Seacole, who some of you may have heard of, the Victorian Jamaican nurse who went to the Crimean War. But she's up there looking down on us, saying, I wasn't the only Black Victorian in England. There were many, many others. And the same is true of Walter Tull, who some of you may have heard of, the Black British soldier who became an officer in the First World War, who's up there looking down on us saying, I wasn't the only Black British soldier in the First World War. There were many others. And it's that really, in a nutshell, what motivated me to do this book. I'm going to begin by talking about my own family background. And it started for me with Aunt Esther. My Aunt Esther was born in Fulham in London in 1912. So she was born before the First World War, 2 years before the First World War. Her father was typical Black colonial, if you like, of his generation. He was a merchant seaman who came to this country, to the mother country. He was a British subject. He was from what was then called British Guyana. And he settled in a seaport, as many Black merchant seamen did. Cardiff, Liverpool. He settled in the East End of London and did what many Black merchant seamen did. He married a white woman and raised a family in London. They actually moved from the East End to where Esther was born, in Fulham. They integrated into a white, predominantly white working class community in West London, as I say. And sadly, Esther's mother died when she was about this age, about 4 or 5 years old. And so Joseph, who worked as a builder's labourer, raised her as a single father in this working class community. When Esther left school at the age of 14, there were hardly any job openings for a Black or mixed race girl in Britain at that time. All working class girls and boys left school at 14 in those days and went into different professions. But for Black and mixed race girls, you either went on the stage and become a chorus girl, or you became a seamstress, and Esther became a seamstress. Moving on, my great-grandmother, who is this big lady who had a big heart, was the mother figure, the matriarch of this working-class community. She was the neighbour of Joseph and Esther. So Esther grew up in this community knowing my family, knowing Granny, so that when Esther's father, Joseph, was killed during the London Blitz of 1941 in an accident during an air raid, Granny, being the big-hearted lady that she was, said, come and live with me, love. It was as simple as that. That's how Esther described it to me. She just said, come and live with me, because Granny had known Esther since she was a child. She'd watched her grow up in this community. So Esther moved in with my family. My mother was living with the family and grew up with Aunt Esther. And so by the time I was born, and my sister was born after the Second World War, Granny had died before we were born, but Esther had become part of our family. So we were raised to look on Esther as our aunt. Moving on to my teenage years, for reasons I won't bore you with, my parents moved to Peckham and married in Peckham in 1954. And so my sister and I were born in Peckham, and that's where I was raised. I went to a secondary modern school, which I hated. So I used to bunk off. Now, when I said that at Middlesex Uni to a load of students the other day, about when I was doing this talk, they didn't have a clue what I meant. And I had to, the lecturer said, could you explain what you mean by bunk off? Oh, get my name in the register and run out the back gate. And what I used to do when I was a teenager, when I was old enough to go on the underground, about 13, 14 years old, I used to travel over to Fulham to meet my older relatives, my grandparents, my great aunts, my Aunt Esther, and talk to them about their lives. And that's where I learned not only about working class history, particularly working class women's history, I also learned about, from Aunt Esther, about the life of a black working class woman in that period. And that resulted in the first book that I worked on. In 1991 it was published, Aunt Esther's Story, which is very much her telling her story. So again, early on, although I was educationally disadvantaged in the formal sense, we didn't do O-levels or A-levels, we didn't know what they were at the school I went to. So I left school with no useful qualifications, but I had already begun to learn about oral testimony, about first-hand testimony, and the importance of first-hand testimony, which for me began with the family. And that's what I impress on young people, to always get history from their older relatives, get them to open up and talk. And even with the First World War story, which I'll come to in a minute, although that generation have gone, Aunt Esther's generation has almost gone, they still told nephews and nieces and grandchildren stories. You have to get those stories out of your relatives in order to get a picture. So the book was published in 1991, and that kind of launched my writing career. And my interest and enthusiasm for finding out more about the home front came from, as I say, the older women in my family. Working class women's experience of the home front in the Second World War is by and large overlooked in the history books. So with Aunt Esther, it kind of stuck in my mind that she couldn't have been, and I knew she wasn't, the only black person in London or in England during the Second World War. So I began to go out and find more information, such as the Nigerian air raid warden who worked in London, who actually wrote about his experiences during the war, and that was published. I found a copy at the British Library. This is when I was very young, and also he broadcast on the BBC, but sadly the only disc that has survived of his broadcast in 1943 is cracked and can't be played. But I found other stories. For example, some of you may have heard of Leary Constantine, the famous sportsman, cricketer from before the war, from Trinidad, who settled in the north of England. So during the war, during the Second World War, he was recruited to work by the government as a welfare officer for the West Indian men that came over in their hundreds all through the war to work in our war factories. Una Marson is on the cover, from Jamaica, a poet, a feminist, a dramatist, came here in the 1930s. By the war years, she'd become established at the BBC and had her own series on BBC Radio during the Second World War called Call in the West Indies, where she would broadcast to the West Indies with guests or West Indian servicemen and women that were based here who wanted to broadcast to their relatives back in the Caribbean. The stories of black evacuees. There's a whole range of stories in this book, but it was a miracle that it was ever published, because when I started going to publishers about this particular book, Mother Country, in 2002, it took 8 years for me to find a publisher in this country. No publisher in this country would touch it. Every time I went to a publisher, they would, black people don't read, black people don't buy books, there's no market for it, blah, blah, blah. which I knew was a load of rubbish. But I persisted, and then eventually, one of the very first publishers I went to, who shall remain nameless, who published, specialised in the Second World War, said they didn't want to detract from the popular image of Winston Churchill and Vera Lynn. So it's like the white, iconic images. So I made sure that went on the cover. When the history press, bless them, the history press took a risk, as they said, we'll take a risk. And the book was published in 2010, and with a lot of hard work, sold out. So then, 2 years later, they commissioned The Motherland Call. So it was relatively easy to get this book published by the history press because they knew I was had a proven track record. I already had, but that counts for nothing. It's the subject matter that publishers resist. It's got nothing to do with me or the colour of my skin or whatever. It's the subject matter that is resisted. So The Motherland Calls was published by the History Press in 2012. And then with the First World War looming on the horizon, the First World War centenary, 4th of August 2014, History Press said, is there any mileage in doing a book on the black servicemen in the First World War? And I said, yeah. Put together a proposal, spent a year writing it. And what I said to the History Press was, I will do the book as long as I can include the wider black community, not just the servicemen in the Navy, in the Army, in the Air Force, of which there were black men from the colonies, from Jamaica, in the very early Air Force. I want to include the wider black community to give them a context and so that people have a chance to read. It's only a slim book, which really it's well-researched and well-written, I'm told. But it is slim because there was no money. There's no funding for books like this. Absolutely no funding whatsoever. So I was limited in what I could research, but fortunately I was able to uncover enough to fill a slim book. As I've mentioned already, Walter Toll was already back in the public eye, so to speak, after decades of being ignored. It was only about 15 years ago that he started to be rediscovered. He was born in Folkestone in 1888, was a fairly well-known, famous footballer in the Edwardian era in England, pioneering black footballer, who then joined what was called the Footballers Regiment in 1914. Was commissioned as an officer in 1917, I think, and is often claimed to be the first black man to become an officer in the British Army. What I say to people, because I've been doing this work for 30-odd years, never, ever, ever claim a black person is the first to do this or the first to do that. We don't know our history. We didn't even know he existed in the British Army until 15 years ago. So how can we make that claim if we don't know? And then when I did further research during the writing of this book, discovered at least two others, other men of mixed ancestry, were commissioned as officers before him. So we have to be careful with what we claim about black people from British history, because we've nowhere near scraped the surface. He sadly didn't survive the First World War. He was killed in action in 1918, but has been fortunately remembered with books and television documentaries. So I wanted to extend the story, and there are many other stories of black British soldiers and West Indian and West African soldiers and sailors in the First World War. Photographs are still coming to light and disproving the misapprehension or misinformation or myth that black men in the British Army were segregated. They weren't. That is rubbish. That is what the Americans did. The Americans segregated black and white in both world wars. Most of us who know anything about this subject know that. We did not do that in Britain. So although there were some recruiting officers up and down the country who discouraged black men from joining up, there was no rule written down. Even the Manual of Military Law states that any person of colour, as they said in those days, can join up. There wasn't that discrimination. I'm not saying there wasn't discriminatory practices once they joined, but by and large, from the evidence I've found, a young black lad could join up in Devon or Liverpool, wherever he may come from. And somebody, a historian, pointed out to me, if he goes to the recruiting office with his white mates, the recruiting officer is highly unlikely to reject him because it would lower the morale of his white comrades. And this is a photograph. We don't know who they are, but they're clearly on the front line in France or Belgium in very poor clothing. They've been in battle. But they're together. They're comrades. And what I've discovered is, because there's very little first-hand testimony and evidence, because very little work has been done on this subject, but what's filtering through is it was the working classes, by and large, white working class men who didn't have an issue with black men from their communities joining up. It was the officer class, the sergeants, the corporals, and so on and so forth, generalising, but this is what's kind of filtering through. If you read the chapter on Norman Manley, who became Jamaica's chief minister and prime minister later on, he served with the Deptford Royal Field Artillery and gives a very clear impression of what it was like to be with the working class Cockneys, as he called them, the Tommies, who embraced him and made him one of their own. And then when he was commissioned, the discrimination, the racism that he experienced made him give up his commission from that kind of class of people. And then another photograph that was brought to my attention after the book was published, which is further evidence of this, but again, we need to do more work, is the Welsh Guards, March 1916, further evidence that there were black men up and down the country integrating into what we would call white or British regiments. And then Private Harold Brown, we know who this young man is because this photograph was given with his certificates of gallantry to the Imperial War Museum. And he was born in the East End in 1899, so he was very young. He was a boy soldier cadet, and then there's a photograph of him as a boy soldier cadet. And then he joined, I think it was the Middlesex Regiment. Sorry, the Royal West Surrey Regiment. So as I say, I keep repeating myself, but we do need to do more research to try and find more examples. He died in 1955. He worked after the First World War on the docks in the East End. Died in 1955, but I don't know how, but his photographs and certificates of gallantry were given to the Imperial War Museum. Moving swiftly on to the British West Indies Regiment, they were formed in October 1915, so there's another very important centenary coming up in October this year, which we must not overlook. King George V had wanted to show the world a united empire in wartime, so in October 1915, the British West Indies Regiment was established as a separate black unit within the British Army. And this was to accommodate the demand from men in the Caribbean who desperately wanted to join up. They couldn't accommodate them in all the British regiments, so they formed this separate black unit within the British Army. And by the war's end in November 1918, the British West Indies Regiment had registered over 15,000 men. 16 soldiers from the British West Indies Regiment were decorated for their bravery, but 185 lost their lives and 697 were wounded. Some critics have claimed that the men from the British West Indies Regiment, when they were sent to the front line, were given menial jobs only. Stacking shells was not a menial job. Stacking shells was a highly dangerous job, because you had the bombs falling. Some of these men, black and white, because these British West Indies Regiment are with their white Australian compatriots, were being constantly bombarded with German shells. So they were killed, they were wounded, they were traumatised. Again, there was this discrimination where they were very rarely, if ever, allowed to rise up the ranks. But there's also a myth that says they were never allowed to to take up arms. So that, by and large, is true. But as I discovered in the research that I did, never accept everything you're told, because I found examples, first-hand testimony, which was research done by a researcher called Tony T, oral testimony, some members of the British West Indies Regiment did take up arms. So did Walter Tull. So again, there's a lot of misinformation that needs to be clarified, and that hopefully will come in time. And then moving on, again, sticking with the British West Indies Regiment, this is a Commonwealth war grave in Belgium, the Poperinge New Military Cemetery in Belgium. It's the final resting place of the 17-year-old Jamaican private Herbert Morris. It's a very tragic story. He was 16 years old in 1916, so a young Jamaican lad who was desperate to join up, so he was allowed to join up. He was sent to the front where he was traumatised, as I say, well, he was shell stuck in, and was traumatised by the guns, constant boom, boom, boom of the guns, and ran away, but he was captured and brought back. But the trauma continued. He more or less had a breakdown, ran off again, came back to the front, was brought back, and was court-martialed and sent for trial. His corporal and his sergeant gave him glowing testimonials. He wasn't given a medical examination. I accessed his papers at the National Archives, and it's quite heartbreaking what happened to him. And they executed him. In 1917, Private Morris was executed for desertion. And this is his final resting place in Belgium, Commonwealth war grave. But then I discovered, after the book was published, but I didn't know this, I do include it in the book, but I didn't know about this place. In 2006, Herbert Morris's case was reconsidered and he was pardoned, along with 300 other soldiers, British soldiers, who were executed for desertion and other offences. And then up in Staffordshire, you've got this fantastic memorial to those 300 soldiers, including Herbert, who were pardoned. And all their names and details are on the posts. Again, somewhere where young people in this country should be taken in school parties to visit, and Herbert should be highlighted as one of the British West Indies Regiment soldiers that was executed and then pardoned. Moving on from the servicemen, of which there is much, 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 much more information in my book, the middle section of the book is about a few, a handful of stories of black citizens in Britain during that period. And it enabled me to include stories of some of the women, black and mixed race women, that were here, living here during the war. Mabel Mercer is one of the most fascinating. She was born in 1900 in Burton-on-Trent to a black father and a white mother. She didn't know either of them. The black father is not named on her birth certificate. Her white mother was what they called then a bohemian, and just disappeared off into the sunset. So Mabel was raised by her grandparents in North Wales, and they sent her to a convent in Manchester. And up until that point, she still hadn't had any contact with any other black person in Britain. So she knew she was different, but she only knew a kind of white world. Then, as I said earlier, when she was 14 years old, two choices. You either become a seamstress or you become a chorus girl. So she went on the stage. And as she later explained, she didn't have a clue what she was doing. Her legs went to jelly every time she walked out on the stage. But she learned. She learned the hard way. Because the main staple of entertainment in those days was music hall. There was no television, no radio. Films were silent. So the troops and the British public would flock to the music halls, of which there were thousands and thousands everywhere you looked, even above pubs. There was some sort of little place of entertainment. And that's where Mabel met other black people. She met other black entertainers. And she joined a black troupe, which was put together by an African-American called Will Garland, who was based here, an expatriate who was based here. And all through the First World War, she's working on the stage as a music hall artist. She wasn't famous. I mean, she was low down the bills. But it started her off in show business. And then later on, she moved over to Paris and in the 1930s worked in Paris in the cabaret circuit. As some of you may know, Paris was where a lot of African-American expatriates went, particularly jazz musicians, because there was more of a welcoming climate there between the two world wars. But sadly, Hitler invaded France, occupied France, and the black American expatriates had to go back to America. And Mabel went with them. Mabel didn't come back to England. She went to America. And in America, after the Second World War, she became the most influential cabaret singer of her generation. Right through the late 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, into the 80s, she held court at various nightclub, kind of cabaret places, and was very influential. Billie Holiday went to see her in the 40s and learnt from her. Barbara Streisand, when she was young, learnt from her. But the most famous singer who said he learnt from her was Frank Sinatra, who was on record as saying she taught him everything he knew about the lyric. Because when he was a younger singer, he would go to see her in New York, because he was from New York himself. She never attained the kind of fame of someone like Ella Fitzgerald in the jazz world. But she is quite a remarkable person, considering her humble beginnings. In the 70s, she was interviewed at length, thank goodness, for a magazine about her early life in England and her work during the First World War in the music hall, so I was able to tap into that. And then she was given the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1983, the year before she died at the age of 84. She only came back to London or England once, and that was in 1977. And I found a lovely, if I had time, I would have played it for you, interview on Woman's Hour, which has been saved in their archive. And so we come to the closing section of the book, which is about the wider black communities in Britain. There would have been black individuals and families living all over the country. But they were already in the seaports in 1914 when the war started, black communities becoming established. This is, I'm talking about Cardiff, Liverpool and the East End of London particularly. This is a very rare photograph that I uncovered of the black community in the East End. When I interviewed the son of this couple for my book Mother Country, because he was an evacuee he gave in the Second World War, and he gave me access to this photograph. And there are very few, actually, that have survived. But the tragedy is, in 1919, those communities were scapegoated by some, not all, but some of the white ex-servicemen. Some of the white ex-servicemen came back from the front line. Imagine what they'd gone through over those 4 years. Doesn't excuse what they did, but they came back to a country that was not a land fit for heroes. There was strikes, there was mass unemployment. So they resented the presence of the black men and their families in the seaports particularly, and attacked their homes, attacked them as individuals. There was a lot of violence, particularly in Cardiff and Liverpool. And it kind of reached ahead. This is a picture I found in the Western Mail, a Welsh newspaper, which says a man of colour addressing a crowd in Tiger Bay district on Friday. This is down in Tiger Bay. He advised his countrymen to do nothing likely to cause trouble, trying to keep a lid on it. And this was Rufus Fenner, who I've written about in the book. We're finding out more and more about him. Fascinating. He'd given war service. He'd come back from the front line and actually came up to London at the height of the riots in 1919 to talk to the government, to talk to politicians. And in doing so, the Welsh police arrested him and took him back to Wales on a trumped-up charge, which the judge threw out because it was just fabricated. And then he kind of disappears from view until he turns up in a 1937 Paul Robeson film as a villain. He had this very interesting, and we were gradually, some of us are piecing together his life. He was American, I believe, and in fact went back to America. But the reason I'm talking about them is black community leaders are beginning to emerge at this time, and that's the important thing. I'll come on to that a bit more in a minute. I just want to stick with Liverpool. What happened in Liverpool? What happened in Liverpool was that Charles Wootton, 24-year-old Bermudian merchant seaman, he was living in a black boarding house in the Toxteth area of Liverpool. But he was at the height of the riots, he was chased by angry rioters from his home. To escape them, he jumped into Queen's Dock in the Toxteth Park area of Liverpool, where he drowned. Now, I found a copy, or was given a copy, of the police report from the Liverpool archives, and it's quite lengthy and detailed. The police report states that whilst attempting to take Charles Wootton out of the dock gates under arrest, the crowd surged forward, overwhelming the police constables, knocking them to the ground. The constables fought desperately to protect him. Wootton was dragged off by the crowd, beaten, weighed down by anchor chain and thrown into the dock and drowned. After this, the police employed heavy tactics, baton and mounted police charges, which dispersed the crowd. Wootton's body was recovered some hours later. Now, Charles Wootton was murdered on June the 5th, 1919. And at the inquest into his death, the coroner for Liverpool decreed that the cause of his death was indeed drowning, but added, quote, how he got into the water, the evidence is not sufficient to show. Didn't he read the police report? So it was a cover-up that Liverpool's black community has never forgotten or forgiven. Now, about two or three years ago, I was invited up to Liverpool to give a talk on my black history books. And yes, they have named a community centre in his honour. They did that many years ago. And they do still remember Charles Wootton. Well, not such remember him, but know of him and what happened to him. It was a lynching. It was the same as what was happening in America. It was a lynching. Only they threw him into the docks and drowned him. So the ultimate sacrifices of black merchant seamen and soldiers during the First World War, the murder of Charles Wootton and the anti-black riots in British cities during 1919 remained in the consciousness of an entire generation of black Britons and colonial people. Thereafter, they and their descendants knew what their fate would be if they did not continue to fight for equality and justice. It is a struggle that has continued for decades, the 1958 Notting Hill riots, the 1981 Brixton and Toxteth uprisings, and the murders of Kelso Cochrane and Stephen Lawrence. So it carries on to this day, but in 1918, just a few weeks after the war had ended, it was addressed by John Archer, the former mayor of Battersea, in a speech at the inaugural meeting of the African Progress Union. Now, John was Liverpool-born of mixed heritage. He was a politician. As I say, he was the first mayor of London, mayor of Battersea in 1913. And the African Progress Union was the title given to one of the very earliest black-led organisations, long before Harold Moody's League of Coloured Peoples. And this was in 1918. And what John Archer said was, our compatriots from Africa, America and the West Indies have been fighting on the fields of France and Flanders against a foreign foe. The people of this country are sadly ignorant with reference to the darker races. If we are good enough to be brought to fight the wars of the country, we are good enough to receive the benefits of this country. And finally, 2 years ago, he was recognised with an English Heritage Blue plaque outside his London home. Mayor of Battersea, who fought social and racial injustice, lived here. So gradually we're beginning to honour and respect the black Britons who fought for justice, who contributed to this country, but it's slow. We're nowhere near up there with the African Americans, who are far ahead of us. And really, I'll end there. But I thank you for listening and hope that you'll find the book either in your local library or to buy it.
This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.